This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, two historians join the show to answer a recent Why Wisconsin question about the history of racially restrictive sundown towns here in Wisconsin. Now, the U.S. Senate passed a foreign aid package today that would give $40 billion to Ukraine for military assistance and humanitarian and economic relief. Meanwhile, President Biden showed his support today for Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Both countries have turned from years of precedent to seek membership since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This all comes as the war in Ukraine continues to grind on with no obvious path to peace. Do you think the U.S. should continue to financially help Ukraine during this war? What do you think of this new package of aid, military and otherwise? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also, do you have questions about two previously neutral countries, Finland and Sweden, seeking to join NATO? What's confusing you right now about the war in Ukraine? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison, specializing in international security topics, including terrorism and war and peace. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
A lot going on in Ukraine right now. Ukraine surrendering at Mariupol after a long siege there. More sanctions on Russia. Russia being turned back in other places. In a nutshell, what do you see as the status of the invasion right now?
Well, it settled into a war of attrition in the east. The Russians gave up on capturing the big cities, the capital, Kyiv in the north, and Kharkiv in the northeast of the country. And the Ukrainians have pushed them back there. But now they've reinforced their positions and are trying to capture more territory in the far east, in the regions around Donetsk and Luhansk, where they had a separatist presence before the war got started back in February. And that progress has been slow. They've made some progress. They've made advances incrementally, but they haven't been able to make the big gains and the big encirclements that they were hoping to achieve and destroy, you know, large chunks of the Ukrainian army. So with that being beyond them, they've been making small incremental gains, and the Ukrainians have been fighting back in small ways as well. So it's settled into a kind of a long war of attrition.
Now we have this new aid package passed now by the Senate, going to President Biden. It had already passed the House. About half of this $40 billion for direct military aid, also economic and humanitarian relief. How much difference does military aid of about $20 billion make to the Ukrainian war effort?
Oh, I think it makes an enormous difference. I think you've seen in the recent battles in the east how that aid has been put to use pretty rapidly. There's a big battle earlier in the week over this river crossing where the Russians tried to cross a river in the eastern region in Donetsk, the Donetsk area. And the Ukrainians were able to target artillery fire on that and basically destroy their pontoon bridges and a lot of the armored vehicles on the other side of the river. So it turned into a major defeat for the Russians. And that's the kind of thing that you really need artillery to cope with. From the earliest days of the war, we've been giving them these shoulder-mounted anti-tank weapons, both the American Javelin and some other European versions, as well as Stinger anti-aircraft style missiles. But those are relatively short range. You have to be sort of within sight of the target for the most part. Artillery, you can hit targets that are 5, 10, 15 kilometers behind the front line. And so that's what you really need to engage forces that are over the horizon, out of sight. And the Ukrainians have been putting those to great use recently. And that's very artillery intensive, very ammunition intensive. You need to have a steady supply of shells to keep that going. And I think that's what the Ukrainians need at this point.
There's been a fair amount of bipartisan support for this aid package. Most Republicans in the Senate did support it, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He said in this interview with PBS NewsHour, he supports the package. He's hoping to see more aid and more action, he says, from President Biden.
The president really needs to step up his game. He has frequently done the right thing, but never soon enough. We now know where we are. The Russians are in the country. We need to do everything we can to give them the tools to fight with. Many of these tools are in the hands of Eastern European NATO allies who are anxious to help.
So even with a bipartisan bill, Senator McConnell are critical of the Biden administration. Do you think that the Biden administration could have done more faster to facilitate the flow of aid to Ukraine?
Possibly in some ways around the margins, but I think mostly that's a product of, I mean, he's the leader of the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, so he needs to find something to be critical of. But I think the main message to be drawn from it is the bipartisan support for the aid to Ukraine. It's really only a small number of Republicans in Congress who've been oppositional to it. So you've seen a kind of a rare window or rare episode of an issue where you've got fairly wide bipartisan agreement on in terms of aiding Ukraine, giving them the weapons they need to fight, and trying to compensate for some of the economic damage that's occurring at the same time. So I think that's really the main takeaway there.
Talking to Andrew Kidd from UW-Madison, looking at the latest news in Ukraine, a big aid package passed by Congress, going to President Biden now for a signature, aiming military and economic and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. Also to, if you'd said this a year ago, two surprising countries trying to become part of NATO now. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your ideas about how the U.S. should or shouldn't support Ukraine right now. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Just mentioned Finland and Sweden seeking to join NATO now. I want to give a listen to President Biden saying earlier today he wants to see this happen.
Finnish and Swedish troops have already serve shoulder to shoulder with U.S. and NATO forces in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, and in Iraq. And both Finland and Sweden are already working in coordination with the United States and our other allies and partners to support the brave people of Ukraine as they defend their freedom against Russia's invasion.
Andrew, as I'm reading stuff, it seems like if I'd said a year ago, yeah, Finland and Sweden are going to seek to join NATO soon, it would have sounded like just wacky talk. It very unlikely. Can you talk about how big a change this is for those two countries?
Oh, it's an enormous change, all right. Those countries have been neutral, not just in the post-Cold War era, but throughout the Cold War and even before. Sweden was neutral during World War II and was one of the few countries not to be invaded by the Nazis. And they took that as a lesson that neutrality works for them, and they maintained their neutrality throughout the Cold War. Finland was neutral in a sense. They had fought the Russians to a standstill to some extent in the Finnish War, the Winter War, the Continuation War, but ultimately realized that they couldn't really go against Russia to any great extent during the Cold War. But thankfully, the Russians were willing to let them be in exchange for not siding with NATO. And so neutrality has worked well for those countries for most of the 20th century. So to get them off of that and into the arms of NATO took a really big shock. And I think that shock, there's both sort of a motivation and a sort of window of opportunity here, in the sense that the motivation is provided by Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which makes Russia look much more aggressive than it used to be and much more threatening to neighboring countries like Finland and Sweden. So that provides the shock and the sort of motivation, the Russian aggression. But the failure of the Russian aggression provides the window of opportunity in the sense that Russia is now temporarily weakened by this. They've lost big chunks of their military forces in Ukraine. The Ukrainians are continuing to fight them effectively. So Russia is in no position to make any sort of conventional military threat against Finland and Sweden at the moment. But of course, if they were to prevail in Ukraine and win, then they would eventually be able to reallocate their forces and target the north once again. So the Scandinavians have this motivation in fear of Putin and window of opportunity in temporary Russian weakness. So they would like to get into NATO quickly and make that happen, so that when this war does end, if Putin were to target his aggression elsewhere, he would meet a unified wall of opposition.
Now, it seems like one of Putin's goals, not just with the Ukraine invasion, but for years, has been to weaken NATO, among other things, by supporting candidates in NATO countries who were less sympathetic, less interested in being active participants in it. So now NATO seems more stronger, unified, and maybe going to grow even more on Russian borders. This seems like a big opposite effect of what Putin would have wanted.
It's definitely an unintended consequence for Russia here, for Putin. It's the exact opposite of what he was hoping for. He was hoping the invasion of Ukraine would, A, succeed, of course, and enable him to retake Ukraine, but B, sort of scare other countries into being more accommodating of Russian interests and reluctance to join NATO. And it's had the exact opposite effect. It's made them more interested in joining NATO, which could have been predicted, but not by him, I guess. So I think, yeah, that's definitely redounded against his goals there.
Andrew Kidd is with us from UW-Madison, looking at the war in Ukraine, the involvement the U.S. has financially and politically, a new big aid package passed by Congress today, maybe more countries joining NATO, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, the path to peace. Is there a path to peace? What do you think? How do you want to see this resolved ultimately? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. What do you think about U.S. financial support for Ukraine? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Andrew Kidd, political scientist at UW-Madison, talking with us about the possibility of Finland and Sweden joining NATO, a U.S. foreign aid package for Ukraine with military and humanitarian funding, and what kind of path to peace there could be here. You could join in at 800-642-1234. $40 billion package passed by Congress to support Ukraine, military, humanitarian, economic aid. Should we do more? Should we do less? What do you hope comes out of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, before we move on from NATO, again, Finland and Sweden want to join. Most countries receptive. Turkish diplomats seem to be on board, but the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, saying, hold on, slow the roll here. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so Turkey's problem, or Erdogan's problem, is at least the problem he's stating, is that Sweden and I think particularly Sweden has some refugees, emigres from Turkey who are associated with the PKK, which is a Kurdish guerrilla group, which is regarded by the Turkish regime as a terrorist organization, which has fought for Kurdish autonomy inside Turkey over the years. And so that is the problem that he's raising anyway. So I think there's going to be an objection there. It may be a case where that will lead to some intra-alliance negotiations, and eventually his concerns will be assuaged and or bought off in some sense. So at this point, I'm not overly worried that this is going to prevent in the long run this from happening. But he seems to be asking for a little bit of compensation here at the minimum. So we'll see what happens.
Now, we've talked, I think, in the past about opposition to the war in Russia, muted. People can go to jail, of course, for opposing the war in Russia. I've been reading about some recent criticism, though, in Russia of the military operation, not from people who are opposed to it, but because they think it's not big enough, that the solution to Russia's quagmire right now in Ukraine is to go bigger, call up reserves and conscripts, go in with a much bigger army. Do you worry that the response within Russia may be to expand the war?
Yeah, that's always a concern. There's no doubt about that. I'm less concerned that voices that you're hearing on social media matter to somebody like Putin. I mean, from his point of view, I think he could put those people in jail in a heartbeat without any problem. So it's not as if they're going to put actual pressure on Putin to do one thing or another. But there certainly are possibilities, things he could do that are more escalatory than has been done so far, right? He could try to order some sort of general mobilization, call up more people through the draft, so we could get more manpower. And then there's also possibilities of escalating in terms of the types of weapons he uses or the types of targets he attacks, the worst scenario being possible use of nuclear weapons. So there are indeed more aggressive stances he could take. The big question for him, I think, is going to be, does taking those stances make his survival in office more or less likely? It might make it more likely that he prevails in Ukraine, but it might also lead to instability inside Russia. You've already seen recruitment offices for the military being firebombed And the anti-war sentiment has been effectively muzzled because people simply get arrested right away if they express any anti-war sentiment. But it's out there. It's bubbling underneath the surface. And I think he's aware of that dimly. And so if he were to pursue some dramatic strategy, like calling up large numbers of draftees, I mean, the possibility is that that works and they go to Ukraine obediently and fight. And the other possibility is that they start to riot and start marching on the Kremlin or something like that. So there's all kinds of dangers when you're in a situation like Putin faces himself. And it may be that even his own personal survival would be enhanced by reducing the sort of de-escalating rather than escalating in Ukraine.
Now, I'm seeing reports here that General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff here in the U.S., had a phone call with his Russian counterpart, first time since February, since basically before the invasion. The official statement was that they discussed, quote, several security-related issues of concern and agreed to keep the lines of communication open, end quote. They're not releasing specific details. What is the value? What kind of things can we get out of that kind of conversation between the heads of the militaries of both countries in a tense situation like this?
It's a slightly good sign. I wouldn't make too much of it necessarily. I mean, it's possibly better than nothing at all. But we have to remember, Putin often tacks back and forth, and he'll make a reassuring gesture or say something that sounds good, and then go against that a couple of days or a week later and do something escalatory or violent, as if he's trying to put people off their guard. You've seen that many times in the current war in Ukraine, leading up to it as well. So I don't put a lot of stock in these sorts of things. Perhaps it's a good idea, though, to have, just as a broad general thing, American military officers and the Defense Secretary as well, having these channels, direct channels, with their Russian counterparts, being willing to pick up the phone could be useful in certain situations if things really did start to escalate dramatically.
We are talking to Andrew Kidd from UW-Madison about the latest in Ukraine after Congress passed a substantial aid package for Ukraine. Still time for your call if you are following this still. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Andrew, Ukraine doesn't want to give up any of its territory, whether from this invasion or from the past Russian interference in parts of the country. Russia doesn't want to come away from this, I would guess, without getting something with those two things on the table. What could be a path to a peace, to an end to this war?
It's hard to see what the path to peace is at this point. It really is. I think you've laid it out correctly there, that Ukraine wants to fight to regain the territory. Certainly, the territory lost since February of this year in the most recent invasion. And more ambitiously, they might even want to get back Crimea, which was taken from them back in 2014. And the Russians, of course, Putin himself, would find it humiliating to get nothing whatsoever for his invasion. So that's a very strong conflict of interest there between the two sides. And in the case that they'll probably continuing to fight it out until it's clear which side is going to win. The other question is, what should U.S. war aims be? There's been a lot of talk lately about how the United States should lean on the Ukrainians to reduce their war aims and be willing to negotiate, be willing to give up territory and some sort of peace settlement with Russia. And I think that's motivated largely by fears of escalation on the Russian side, fears of nuclear escalation in particular. So you have seen some talk along those lines, but most, for the most part, there's, I think, pretty uniform support for Ukraine getting back its territory lost since 2014, or since February of this year, although probably less so for Crimea. So I think right now the United States is still pretty much lined up behind Ukraine and its war aims. There's been talk of more grandiose war aims, which I think is probably not a good idea, from the United States, from occasional American leaders talking about weakening Russia or, you know, regime change in Russia, Putin being overthrown. And those should not be our goals. We should be perfectly happy if we have a restoration of the status quo pre this year. Putin doesn't have to leave power. We're not seeking any broader weakening of Russia, or at least we shouldn't be, as far as I'm concerned. Conflict resolution, ending this war on favorable terms to Ukraine should be the goal.
And then I just want to spend our last minute or so on the humanitarian situation. Millions of people displaced and left Ukraine, millions more displaced within the country. Seeing reports that some people are going back from Poland into Ukraine, you know, in the five-digit numbers, not in the millions. What are you watching for when it comes to the people displaced by this war?
Well, people coming back would be hopeful, and I think it is hopeful. I think people can come back certainly to Kyiv, the capital, and possibly soon to Kharkiv as well, which are the two biggest cities. So that could draw a lot of people back from Poland and from the other Eastern European countries where they've gone, and the internally displaced people as well. I think you're going to see a lot of continuing horror stories coming out of the south and the east, where Russians are being where Ukrainians are being forced into Russia in Russian-occupied areas, where the Russian grip is being tightened on those cities and towns. So I think we're going to see a lot of problems there and a lot of uncertainty about what happens to Ukrainians who have been taken into Russia. And I think we're going to see continuing exposés of mass graves and atrocities in other areas that are liberated by the Ukrainian forces. So I think it's going to continue to tell the tale of a very brutal Russian occupation that is very much not obeying any sort of or making any pretense of obeying or respecting humanitarian or international law in this conflict.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Andrew specializes in international security topics, including terrorism and war and peace. He talked with us today about the war in Ukraine, the U.S. aid package just passed today by Congress, and the possibility of Finland and Sweden joining NATO after decades of neutrality. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, addiction can be a struggle for family members, and it raises questions about the best ways to help a loved one dealing with addiction. Kate's guest has advice and answers to your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Some good news from Wisconsin's trails. As you may have heard from WPR News, Wisconsin's popular Elroy to Sparta Trail officially reopened last weekend after flooding damage a few years back. The DNR says the 32-mile-long trail gets as many as 60,000 visitors in a year. I also stumbled across a national event with a lot of action here in Wisconsin. June 4th is National Trails Day, organized by hiking groups to get people out on trails and to encourage people to volunteer to help maintain those trails. They've got a map of events up at AmericanHiking.org. I counted 8 around Wisconsin and a couple more right across state lines. One highlight at Kickapoo Valley Reserve in Lafarge, Llama Packing 101, intro and workshop. Yes, hike with a llama. Learn how. Again, find the full event map online at AmericanHiking.org. Hiking and llama news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, demand for mental health services has skyrocketed during the pandemic. The technology world is trying to meet that demand with therapy apps, but how well do they really work? Find out today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, when people think about the history of racism in the U.S., many think of slavery and segregation in the South. There's often less focus on racism that existed in places like the Midwest, where discrimination often took on different forms. Sundown towns were places that didn't allow people of color to be in a city after dark, and they were common around the Midwest for a lot of the 20th century. Lori Lambrees recently asked WPR's Why Wisconsin project about sundown towns in Wisconsin. That's after she found out that Manitowoc, the city where she lives, had been a sundown town.
I was shocked. I don't even remember when I first heard that term. But somebody was talking about it, and I, you know, sundown town, and I'm like, what is a sundown town? And they said what it was, and I'm like, no way, there's no way that Manitowoc was ever that. And I kind of checked into it, and it was, and I was just like, I can't imagine.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you heard stories about these kind of sundown restrictions, formal or informal, in your own community's past? Why do you think this history isn't very well known? What's the right way for communities to look back and acknowledge, maybe even make amends for these kind of things? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sabrina Robbins is a public historian and board member of the grassroots group African Heritage, Inc. She's also a member of the American Association of State and Local Histories, the Wisconsin Historical Society, and advisory member of the Unvarnished Project. Sabrina, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Stephen Berry is an associate professor of history and American culture at the University of Michigan. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Stephen, what do we know about how common these sundown town arrangements were in the Midwest and in Wisconsin?
That's a great question. It was pretty common, especially from the late 19th century into most of the 20th century. And as you noted, in some places, these practices still continue. But it was a common feature of the Midwest, as well as the West and the East. The place where we see fewer sundown towns is in the South. And in part, that's because the South had its own kind of racial system parallel to this at the same time, something we know well in terms of segregation and Jim Crow practices. And so in lots of respects, the practices of sundown towns is a response West, Midwest, East, and it's very much connected to other kinds of Jim Crow practices in the same period.
And Sabrina, you say we should look at sundown towns, but also see them as kind of, a continuum of different forms of discrimination and exclusion of people of color. Can you talk about that range of things people might have encountered?
Absolutely. When looking at the Black experience, sundown town sort of denotes, you know, leave before the sun goes down. And it really doesn't look at some of the other practices and laws and other ways of enforcing to monitor and control Black movement, mindset, and just its mere existence. And so while we have seen some progress, we have current day practices going on, driving while Black, sleeping while Black. You have members of white communities come and confronting Black teens and others. Why are you here? And, you know, give me your driver's license. So those types of attitudes and behaviors are born out of sundown town Jim Crow laws and slavery itself. So I like to say that we need a more functional view of what sundown town is that's still impacting Black life in terms of healthcare, education, jobs, and other forms of just normal life outcomes.
And Sabrina, you were part of a research team looking into Appleton and their history, whether or not it was a sundown town. Can you give us a taste of the sort of things you found?
Absolutely. I just want to back up and say that we started this project as a truth and reconciliation engagement so that we can move forward to a more equitable town and more equitable region. When we started the project, many of the residents said that Blacks didn't come into the region until about the late 1960s. In reality, we have documented firsthand, voice experiences dating back to the 1700s. So the number one finding that we have is that people simply said they didn't know. They didn't know it was a sundown town. They didn't know that Blacks were in the area. And we had really lost the community memory of Black presence at all. And so our research was very important because it documented Black life right after the Reconstruction. We had a black aristocracy, and members of that aristocracy were business owners. So hair, owning hair salons, working as social workers and educators in the area. We had a gentleman, Joseph Elmore, that owned a circus, and that we had a thriving community in the early, in the 1865 era. And so, again, that memory is not included in the Appleton history at all. And so now we have a way to include more voices and have a more inclusive view of what is Appleton, who lived here, and what was life like.
Now, Stephen, for sundown towns, can you talk about how they worked on a practical level? And I understand some might have had a formal law. Some, it was just something that everybody knew.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just add, too, that sundown towns, especially today, we're focusing on places that excluded Black people. But we also have evidence of sundown towns that excluded Asian Americans, Native Americans, Jewish populations. And so in depending on where it is and the various groups who are in that area, there are lots of ways in which we see various examples of racial and ethnic exclusion. And in terms of how it worked, as you noted, sometimes towns did pass a law or an ordinance declaring that a particular group couldn't live in that town. It was sometimes okay for people to be in the town during the day if they were working, but the ideal that they had to be out by sundown was, of course, the notion that they couldn't live in that town. And sometimes that was an ordinance, but also perhaps even more often it was through other means, informal means, that it was enforced, and the ways in which, you know, there's an example of police escorting people who arrive on a train at the railroad station, escorting them out of town. There are examples of signs being put up on the edges of towns that are often with overtly racist language, stating that a particular group has to be out at sundown. And often there were town whistles that would go off at the end of the day that was signaling that it was time for anybody who was a Black person to be out of town. And in addition to these, the ways in which it was implemented, it was also enforced often through, in some cases, through violence or the threat of violence, including mobs forming, especially if there was a triggering event to drive a particular group out of a town. But also it functioned from people who probably thought they were being helpful by saying, oh, you shouldn't be in this town after this this time. And that sort of word of mouth of people essentially policing these places themselves. And of course, then reputation spreads about particular places that these are places to avoid. All of those things are part of how these practices were implemented and enforced over time.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Hal is with us in Wausau. Hal, hello. Are you there, Hal?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I grew up in central Illinois in a sundowner town, and I was in grade school in the late 50s and early 60s. My parents owned a small six-unit motel, and there was an ordinance, I believe there was an ordinance on the books saying that people of color could not be in town after sundown. And if a person's car would break down, it was right along Highway 51, a busy highway. The police knew the only place they could bring a family or a person of color to spend the night was to my parents' motel.
And that's what you grew up seeing, Hal.
Yeah, I did. I think part of the reason that happened is in the late 1800s, it was a coal mining town and there was a strike. And the rich coal mine owners brought in Black strike breakers, and there ended up being a riot and a mob, and I think a few people got killed. And I think that's when they passed the ordinance back in the late 1800s.
Hal, thanks for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up with our guests in just a couple moments, Sabrina Robbins and Stephen Berry, two historians with us to answer a Why Wisconsin question about the history of sundown towns here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories of these formal or informal racial restrictions, maybe as Hal did, where you grew up or in your own community now? Do you think it's important to document that history and look into it? And what do we do about it then? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about a Why Wisconsin question we recently got from a listener asking about the history of sundown towns in Wisconsin. We're talking to Sabrina Robbins with African Heritage, Inc. and Stephen Berry with the University of Michigan. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own memories of racial restrictions, official or informal, where you've lived. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sabrina, you talked about connecting the dots between the past and what happens in communities nowadays. What do we lose if we don't remember, if we don't look at the history of sundown towns and other kinds of racial exclusions from our past?
We lose several things. One, understanding of how a city came to be. One of the great things about history is just knowing not only your founding or origins, but what are the experiences of people that live in that area. And if you don't have all the information, you miss the opportunity to have the full understanding of what life is. The other thing we miss is we repeat the same mistakes. So as we look at communities in northern Wisconsin, including Appleton, if you don't know that Blacks exist in the area, that they were contributors, then you would be confused by the Black Lives Matter activity that took place in a region that is overwhelmingly white. And so as you look at it today, many of the local residents were very surprised that cities like Appleton and Green Bay and some of the other smaller cities all had Black Lives Matter activities and marches going on, because they don't understand the connection between our region and the larger national narrative, or even the regional narrative, when you look at what is our relationship to Milwaukee, to St. Louis, and to Chicago, even. And so having a fuller understanding of your region helps provide more context and understanding of where you fit in the larger national narrative of American history and African American history.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Chuck is with us in Dodgeville. Chuck, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just wanted to say that I recently read the book Sundown Towns by James Lewin, and it's an excellent book. I'd recommend it to anyone, and it really chronicles how sundown towns evolved, especially in the Midwest, including Wisconsin, and how he said how perhaps 100 years or so ago, there were a lot more Black people living in areas like the Fox Valley and southeast Wisconsin. But they were actually pushed out. And then within 50 years or so, say by the 1960s or 70s, that they were almost exclusively kept in Milwaukee and in inner city Milwaukee they were. And the second point I wanted to make was, author can confirm this, it was said that towns that had the word green in it that was code for African Americans not coming there or not living there. So you have towns in Wisconsin, and I'm not sure if that included Green Bay or not. I assumed it was, but towns like Spring Green and Greenfield or Greendale and things like that.
Chuck, thanks for the call. Stephen, I think you're familiar with that book. Do you have an answer for Chuck's question about the green part of city names?
Yes, it's an interesting point. I am familiar with that book and will also encourage people who are listening to read that book. It is the most extensive research that's been collected on sundown towns nationally, including quite a bit about Wisconsin. And I also want to mention that there's a website connected to that research, and which you can probably find by Googling sundown towns or by going to the History and Social Justice website, which is hosted at Tougaloo College. And in response to that question, I know that that Jim, who did this research, he did make that point that there was quite a number of places with green in the title that were also sundown towns. And I think for his part, it only rose to the level of, is this a coincidence or not? And I don't think he was ever able to conclusively suggest that there was a connection to that, that it was most likely something coincidental, but also something that Jim found particularly interesting in doing the research for this book.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're going to put that a link to that map up at WPR.org/Central Time, a searchable map of sundown towns by state. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a couple quick comments and kind of a question. So I majored in history, and one of the courses that I took was about Wisconsin history specifically, and actually one of our textbooks was from a WPR personality. I can't remember her name offhand, but sorry. But we learned about sundown towns, and talked about those in class. But I've observed since then that most people I've spoken with aren't really aware of that chunk of Wisconsin's past, and I think that has sort of moved into the modern era in, the fact that Wisconsin is one of the worst states to be a young Black male in. And I think there's still a lot of progress to be made in the state. But I live in Appleton, and something that I've seen over the last, 30 years has been that we've gotten more Black people moving to the area. So I think that's nice to see.
Michael, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time left. To his first point, Sabrina, about spreading the word about the existence of this history. This is something I know you've spent a lot of time on. You've worked, among other things, on traveling museum exhibits and more. How do you think the story needs to be told and spread about sundown towns and other institutions like them?
Sure. It needs to be told widely and told by many. And so I'm very encouraged that this caller is from Appleton. I live there. We partnered with Lawrence University, the police department, the History Museum at the Capitol. So our pop-up museum has had over 100,000 views. The schools, it travels around to all of the K-12 schools, City Hall, the universities. We participate in programs such as this. Our work still continues. And so many people in Appleton and the surrounding areas are not aware of this. And so we have to bring it to the memory, link it to today's activities so that we have a path of how to move forward and no longer engage in sundown town practices. That is there, and join in the work and make this more of a community project and not just something that one or two of us carry out.
And in just our last minute or so, Stephen, are you seeing more communities doing the work that Sabrina has been doing in the Appleton and Fox Valley area, trying to find these stories and retell these histories?
Yes, I am. And I'm really glad that Sabrina mentioned that's my hope too, is that people will want to take up this research. We receive hundreds of emails a week, often about potential sundown towns, and also people reaching out, wanting to talk about how they can do this research and what the historical method is. And I would say too, that I very much hope that other groups will want to take this up, as well as take up this conversation about sundown towns, not only to talk about the past, and I agree it is It is really important to tell the truth about the past, but also to think about the future and think about what kind of community do they want to be in the future, and how do you become a welcoming community in the future, and connect that to some of these historical incidents in the past.
We'll leave it there. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Sabrina, thanks for being with us. That was, we've been hearing from Sabrina Robbins, public historian and board member of African Heritage, Inc. She's an advisory member of the Unvarnished Project. And Stephen Berry is associate professor of history and American culture at the University of Michigan, with us today to answer a Why Scotson question about the history of sundown towns in Wisconsin and to share how you can research racial restrictions in your own community. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, U.S. Soccer reached a first-of-its-kind deal to create pay equity for men and women in the sport. We'll find out what led to the move and what it could mean. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, some blue states are changing their laws to expand access to abortion in preparation for a post-Roe v. Wade world. A reporter tells us what's going on. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.